You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for April 1st, 2016. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the new Springfield headquarters of the Donald or Bust movement, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Because, yeah.
April Fools.
April Fools. We have finally seen the light, Ron Fournier. We finally believe that if we just disrupt the system, man, enough, the revolution will come and something, something, something. And sure, millions of ordinary people might get screwed and their lives might be ruined and their kids' lives might be ruined. But eventually, the corrupt duopoly will come crashing down. And those
and,
of you
and Ron Fournier and Susan Sarandon will wind up on the same side of the bed together. Is that it?
Exactly. And they shall emerge from the pit.
Okay.
You know, this, you know,
whatever.
I don't mean to get all like provocative and stuff, but this is the same logic Charles Manson used. Here's what we'll do. We'll hide out in the desert and they'll start a race war. And eventually the black people will win, but they're too stupid to rule themselves. So we will emerge and rule the earth. And there is a certain really, really condescending assholery in people who say, well, you know, Donald Trump, yeah, he's bad, but, you know, disrupting the system in some really, really catastrophic way is
the way to break up the big banks. That'll do it.
That'll do it. Because, you know, out of
economic collapse of the world will show those big banks where we really stand.
Well, and those nice, you know, working class women who would like to have some prenatal care, please.
Yeah.
And the people who would like to, you know, feed elderly folks. And we have a dental clinic here that just shut down because they couldn't get the budget in line. All of those things, all those real people with real problems who are hanging on by their nails at the margins, all those people, well, those people would just have to sacrifice their, you know, their immediate political interests for the greater good of the revolution.
No, the community of 2,400 that has one dentist lost their dentist because there's no budget in Illinois. And so the dentist isn't getting any of their Medicaid funding or any of their Medicare funding or getting paid on time and can't stay open. So no dentist for you.
But
really.
But come the revolution.
Yeah.
Something, something, something.
Something,
and,
something.
And you know what? I don't disagree with the ends of these people. I don't disagree that big change are necessary. But I am deeply suspicious of people who urge other people to be cannon fodder in their revolution, because eventually it'll all fucking well work out. Except, of course, while people are actually, you know, punching each other in the streets. We saw like 10 minutes of Hoffa last night. That's what it looks like. That's what a revolution looks like.
You know, and a lot of kids get caught in the crossfire of revolutions around the world die.
The bulls beating the shit out of labor.
Yep.
And torching them and firing them and threatening them. That's what it really looks like. And so if you are able to hop on a jet with your pal and fly out of the war zone and pontificate safely from some faraway place where everything's
good. It's really good to bargain away everyone else's health care if you're a healthy 21-year-old male, male, who's on their parents' health insurance and because of Obamacare, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't think about these things. And I get it. I mean, our children don't think about these things because they're kids.
Right.
You know, I'm not trying to be patronizing, but I had to our kids are away this week. And I was chatting on text, you know, which my middle child completely takes for granted that she can text me at any time. And she takes that technology for granted. She takes my time for granted. She does all of that because she's 13. She's my child. Mm-hmm. But I had to explain to her she is with some people. This week she's safe and she's having a lot of fun, but, she was exposed to a Trump supporter, within her immediate vicinity. Mm-hmm. And, I had to explain to her about both Rust Belt and white flight schools. Mm-hmm. And I had to explain both of those things to her via text because she didn't understand why this particular person that she was talking to felt the way they did. Mm-hmm. And I had to explain, look, this person is living in the Rust Belt and goes to a white flight school surrounded by people who don't like, you know, people that aren't white. And she was just shocked and mm-hmm. said, you know, this is America. Why do we live here? And I, again, had to pull back and say, look, because she's such a Bernie supporter.
She is.
Right? She's huge, as people of her generation are. And you and I, you know, agree with so much of what Bernie says.
And we want to encourage them to keep believing.
Continue to supporting Bernie no matter what. Absolutely. I'm not trying. You know, you and I are happy with whomever the Democratic nominee is.
Yes.
And I want to be clear about that. We've always said that.
We will vote for the Democratic nominee.
We will vote blue
will
in November, period.
Bernie Sanders.
Yes. And, but our children are all in for Bernie. Yeah. And but I had to say to her, she said, why do we live here? Why, you know, why can't we just get out of this and not be around these kind of people? And I said, because your job is to make this country a better place. And that's what Feel the Burn is about.
Right.
And so you've got a job to do it. Feel the Burn isn't just something you put on a water bottle and a button. And then, you know, you look cool on Instagram. It is mm-hmm. work. And you have to get to work on making the world a better place. That's what we do.
And you know who would agree with you?
Who? Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders yes. has been working on these issues for 3 times longer than you have been alive, middle child.
Yep. Yep,
and he's going to go right on. Win, lose, or draw, he's going to go right on working on these issues,
mm-hmm.
as are all people of good conscience who are deeply committed yep. to making this country a better place to live.
And living up to its own ideals.
Yeah.
And that's, as you said last week, that's what the civil rights movement is about. That's what Black Lives Matter is about. It's about making America live up to its ideals. So, Driftglass, let's switch gears real quick. Happy blogiversary.
Oh, thank you, Blue Gal. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, is it really 12 years?
Well, I'm starting.
Oh, you're starting your 12th year.
I'm starting my 12th year of
trying. This is your 11th blogiversary.
For 11 long years, I've been trying to get fired from the blogosphere. I have tried everything I can think of to be ignored and marginalized and fired. And thus far, no one has fired me from the blogosphere. So I'm going to continue trying to piss off my employer for one more year.
And you, whoever your employer is, I don't know.
It's nobody. It's nobody.
You're self-employed.
That's the problem. I'm self-employed, and therefore I am unbought and unbossed. And that comes with certain ups and downs.
Yeah. But you got a woman. You got scotch.
I did. I got everything I asked for.
You got a smidgen of money.
I got everything I asked for from the internet. I said, yeah. give me a hot woman. Give me scotch and make me wealthy beyond the dreams of Croesus. Now, I didn't get the last one. I'm much poorer than I was when I started blogging.
Yeah.
By a life savings worth, a condo's worth, and a job's worth of earthly treasure. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Okay, that's fine. Me and millions of other people like me are in this mm-hmm. situation. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's not personal. That's just business. But everything mm-hmm. else, the internet has lived up to everything else. People occasionally send me a bottle of scotch. They occasionally drop a couple of coins in my on an irregular basis in my tip jar, and I'm deeply grateful for that. Even though I'm way behind on thank you notes, and I got I met a beautiful woman, and I have a lovely family thanks to the Tinder, the left wing mm-hmm. Tinder known as the blogosphere.
Yeah, that's right. We met on the blogosphere.
We did.
So. That's a good thing,
yeah.
And I'm very glad that the blog world brought us together.
I am
okay.
too, and the rest of them could go hang, as far as I'm concerned.
So the thing that kind of erased all news from the and sucked all the air out of the room again.
What could it have been, Blue Gal? What could it have been?
Could it have been Donald J. Trump? Yes, it could. He said something that just can't be unsaid. Although he tried, about women who have had abortion should be punished, or
right.
women who have abortions after he makes it illegal mm-hmm. will be punished. And this is, like I said, something he cannot unsay. And
he's been trying all day long. He's been trying to walk that back.
But it calls out the lie of the Republican stand on abortion.
Exactly.
Which is, oh, no, it should be illegal. It should be illegal. And then it turns out, OK, if it's illegal, then somebody's breaking a law, right? And if somebody's breaking a law, then you have to have consequences for law breaking, right? And it turns out that conservatives, just like all of us, are actually comfortable with the incongruity of it, that people can hold two ideas in their head at the same time. And liberals do that. You go and do man on the street interviews, and John Oliver did this.
Mm-hmm.
And he came across a lot of young people who said, well, you know, personally, I'd never have an abortion. If I had an accidental pregnancy, I wouldn't have an abortion. But I'm not going to tell anyone else to do that. I'm not going to tell anyone else to make that choice, and that choice needs to be available.
Mm-hmm.
That is the opinion of the majority of people in this country.
That huge majority.
Yeah. They're not comfortable with the idea of it. It's not something that they want to think about a lot.
Or for themselves. They will not limit someone else.
And they certainly understand the really horrible consequences of an unplanned pregnancy for people,
right,
and how that can really change your life and really be horrible, especially if you are a woman or know a woman that you care about, and mm-hmm. and they have economic needs. You know, people have abortions because they've been raped. People have abortions because for all kinds of reasons, because they already have two children, and if they have another baby, they'll lose their house, you know, mm-hmm. if they have to take time off of work. We are not kind to mothers. We do not put a dollar value on motherhood, mm-hmm. Unlike a lot of countries. But that whole
big spectrum
yep.
of people who are abortion on demand, no matter what, whenever,
yep.
to I'm personally uncomfortable with it, but you know what? I'm not going to impose my beliefs. That whole spectrum has a name. It's called pro-choice.
Yes, it's called pro-choice. Exactly.
And so the majority of this country is pro-choice.
Yep.
Overwhelming majority of this country is pro-choice. And Donald Trump, bless his psychotic little heart.
Yep.
And I will do what I rarely do, give Chris Matthews credit.
I know.
Because
I know.
This
it's hard
that,
to do that.
This is something that you, Blue Gal, have been talking about for years.
Yes, I have.
Which is, you know, abortion exists as a fundraising issue.
Mm-hmm. It's a guaranteed cash register of the right.
Absolutely.
Yep.
It is the number one or number two fundraising ATM machine for the right. They do not want it made illegal. They want to rail against it and pound the Bible on it and point fingers of shame, shame, and talk about body parts and selling body parts and Planned Parenthood. They want all that hue and cry and Elmer Gantry bullshit because it brings the money in. But when mm-hmm. it comes down to it, when you say, okay, how many years should a woman spend in prison for having an abortion? That's when the conversation suddenly goes, wait a minute. Because now we're talking about your daughter. Now we're talking about possibly putting your daughter in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something they don't want to talk. They will talk about doctors all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Donald Trump is doing. He walked back this whole punish women thing. But when it gets right, and now he's talking about punishing doctors, which we already do. In fact,
mm-hmm.
we make it really easy, Bill O'Reilly. We encourage people to kill doctors, blow
yep.
up their clinics. And then we say, oh, we didn't really mean that. We called them baby killers 5,800 times on the air and pointed where they are and where they go to work and what their route to work is. We didn't really think anyone would do anything about it. We just wanted to, you know, build our ratings.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it comes down to it, you're talking about punishing women under law for breaking the law, or else the law has no meaning. And Chris Matthews really pushed that. All right. And Donald Trump did what and this is how you know he's a true conservative, because he shit himself and weaseled and tried to change the subject. Well, you're Catholic, Chris, aren't you? Yeah, I'm Catholic, but I'm not running for president. I don't think the Pope should run the country. I'm asking you what your policy would be. What's the penalty for someone having an abortion? And those are the moments when you actually take a conservative and take their policy and stick it with a pin right in their forehead and say, all right, tell me, Paul Ryan, what's going to happen to all the poor people who will starve to death when your policies are implemented? Okay, Ted Cruz, when all these people start dying because you've repealed every word of Obamacare, what do you want to do with their bodies? And no one asks them that question because it's bad for ratings. And they'll never talk to you again. They'll never come on and meet the press again. But Chris Matthews, to his credit, actually pushed it. And that has gobbled up the news cycle, which had previously been dominated by Mr. G. Gordon Lewandowski.
Gordon Lewandowski, yes. Who was arrested this week.
Yeah, yeah. When
I mean, this is an archetype
yeah.
in Republican politics, to have a hitman, to have a thug, and I'm going to use that word. I know how weighted that word is, but to have some alpha male, violent, sexist
goon,
power goon on your staff to be the enforcer, right?
H.R. Haldeman.
Yeah, exactly. And he looks like H.R. Haldeman. It's hilarious. Yeah, yep, yep.
But they are attracted. I mean, this is authoritarian types, fascist types attract these people. And then they're turned loose by them. They're liberated by them. And they're caught on tape by them now. And as we are learning for the umpteenth time, the fact that you can point a camera, point to videotape and say, here is your guy doing this thing. What does Donald Trump do? Again, this is how you know he's a true conservative. He weasels and he waffles and he changes the subject and he whines about this, about how he was assaulted. He's the victim here. And that's how you know he's a true conservative, because he takes no personal responsibility for the absolutely horrific shit that he says. And when cornered, he tries to shift the blame onto someone else, because let's face it, if you're a conservative Republican and it's 2016, you're basically a fucking coward.
Mm-hmm.
You are hiding out from the consequences of 20 years of your own bad mistakes. And so he's a perfect conservative. As we said, 36 hours after Donald Trump came down the escalator and into our lives, that man is the Republican Party. That man is the GOP. And my God, he just keeps proving us right, Blue Gal.
Yep.
So those Soros checks should be coming in any day now.
Right.
I have a note. I have a little note to myself here.
Yeah.
Which is the clip from Jackie Brown.
Uh-huh.
What is Donald Trump doing? He's messing with their levels.
He's messing with my levels,
He's
man.
He's messing with their levels.
Don't mess with my levels.
They have the stereo. They have the Wingnut stereo set exactly the way they like it.
Yeah.
It's just loud enough for them to hear, but not so loud that the people in the mainstream media have to start paying attention to it.
Yeah.
They have their levels set just right. Ronald Reagan set them just right. You can say all the crazy ass racist, homophobic, xenophobic shit you want on the Rush Limbaugh show.
But
you make sure the volume, the bass and the treble are set just enough so that Meet the Press doesn't have to cover it.
Exactly. And there is a wall between right wing hate radio and right wing television. And so the universe
doesn't have to
which always
this.
Makes you cock an imaginary shotgun. I notice that whenever I mention the Hugh universe. Hewitt's universe, his bonus. His bonus website, anything Hugh Hewitt says on the radio never makes it when he's on the panel at Meet the Press.
No.
And he can say the craziest shit, and it doesn't matter.
Well, Newt Gingrich can say the most racist, awful shit, and he does, and tweet the most awful shit, and he does. Never asked about it on the air. And the entire right-wing media machine can crank it up to 10.5, and David Brooks will never notice it. He will just write about it. He will write right over it as if it doesn't exist. And now Donald Trump has messed with their levels. Now he's cranked up the bass. He's cranked up the volume. And all the shit they've been saying among themselves is now part of our mainstream political dialogue. And it's freaking them the fuck out.
Would you take 5 minutes and talk about David Brooks on the Charlie Rose show? Because he was on for 50 minutes.
He was. No. No. I wrote a long thing about it, which you can read at my
blog.
Okay,
so everybody should just go over to Drift Glass and read his long thing.
Read my long thing. It's very long. It's huge. It's huge.
But there was, if you can boil it down to the core conflict in David Brooks's brain, because this is how you were talking about it yesterday, I really liked.
There's a movie. A story in a movie called Scanner Darkly by Philip Dick. In it, there's a drug called Substance D. And what Substance D does to its addicts is split your brain in two, so that the two halves of your brain are actually in competition with each other. They don't talk to each other. So that by day, our protagonist is a DEA officer, a narcotics officer. And by night, he's a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts to forget that the person who he's chasing by day is the person who he is at night and who's paranoid that he's being chased all the time. And he completely dissociates between these two halves of his brain. And the hours-long worth... And you shouldn't watch the thing. It's just a boring-ass, dirigible ride through David Brooks's superego. But the upshot is, the first half of the interview, the first portion of the interview, was David Brooks crying into his very expensive artisanal craft beer about how the Republican Party is fucked up and how he missed it. And, oh my God, you know, I travel the Acela Corridor, which is this train that runs, you know, from Boston, New York to D.C.
And costs $200 for a first-class ticket. Yeah.
And it's literally where the elite meet to talk about the rest of us peons and scumbags out in the country. But it's this bubble. It's become a metaphor for this bubble that the Beltway media and politicians and consultants all live in. And they all operate inside this weirdly universe that has nothing to do with our world at all. And they're rich and they're protected and they invent these little stories about what's going on out in the hinterland, which all turn out to be bullshit. But David Brooks's stock and trade was always telling people what people are like at Applebee's.
Yes, right. What the folks salad are like. Bar at Applebee's that didn't exist.
And the folks down on Main Street, you know, the good folks, the salt of the earth. In fact, remember that one time I jogged past a bunch of Tea Partiers and by God, they're just the best sort of people. And he literally wrote a column and then went on Meet the Press and reiterated his column about jogging past a bunch of Tea Partiers.
Mm-hmm. Stop. We were getting along with the black picnic that was going on right next door, and everybody was happy on a sunny day. Yeah,
which he extrapolated this entire, you know, socioeconomic picture of America from that one little interaction he'd had. So, and now he's like, oh shit, I missed it. I mean, he's actually copping to the fact that I missed it. I do travel. I go to colleges, but colleges are in the bubble. And he's begging to keep his job. This is directed straight at his bosses of the New York Times saying, I'll do a better job. I swear I will. I'll go out and talk to weirdos. I'll talk to shit shovelers in Nebraska. I promise. But what he's discovered is, and this is him talking about his party, is that for 25 years, why are these people mad? Charlie Rose asked. Well, for 25 years, the elite in the GOP have harvested the votes of the base and given them nothing. Wow. Liberal bloggers could have written that.
Yeah.
They have been writing that.
They have written that.
And the Reaganomics.
Little red state fundy, isn't that what you wrote? The little red state fundy who gets nothing from all the work he does to get the votes out.
And he finally turns on them.
Yep.
That I wrote 11 years ago.
and
thought about, you know, 10 years before that, as most liberals have. So that these voters are really pissed off. They are completely divorced from the elite in the party. They are willing to turn to an authoritarian figure, flock to an authoritarian thug who has no interest in their problems at all. And that somehow we all missed it. And this is where both he and Charlie Rose just sat there, you know, commiserating. Oh, you know, Charlie, I missed it. Well, pretty much everybody missed it. Yeah, pretty much everybody missed it. You know, David Brooks says, some people will pretend that they saw this coming, but nobody really saw this coming. Isn't that right? Oh, yes. So they're giving each other this lovely hand job under the table about how this was completely unknowable and completely invisible. But what he says in the first half of the interview is essentially what liberals have been saying for a quarter century, that Reaganomics is a failure. Reaganomics has become a prison for the Republican Party, that it is stifling any discussion, that Republicans do not believe in government for anything, and therefore there's no way they can solve wage stagnation or inequality because they don't believe in government.
And
those solutions don't work anymore. And
he does say Reaganomics was great for the 80s.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. But I have to say that or I'll just get, you know, I'll have to hire someone to start my car for me from now on.
Yeah.
So the first half of the interview, his left brain is saying, isn't it weird how I forgot and missed all this? And how could anyone have caught this? And, you know, I've talked to these people. I have talked to them, but I just didn't believe them when they told me this shit. So he says it was my bias. I just didn't see it. Second half of the interview. You know, the problem is if only Barack Obama had been more of a compromiser. Here's the thing. He came into office with a mandate, you know, with a vote. And he has good bipartisan tendencies. He really, really wants to be bipartisan. But he offered this orthodox Democratic, you know, policies that alienated Republicans. You know, you could get a really good poverty program going if only progressives and evangelicals would agree to solve the problem together. And everybody, you take a little bit from this side, a little bit from that side, in the middle somewhere, this magical center somewhere, you'll find it. And Obama wanted to do that in his heart, but his policies were so lefty, so democratic, so orthodox, that, you know, he just completely alienated the Republican Party.
And no talk about how Republican Party has blocked everything.
No talk about the Republican Party blocking everything. No talk about the fact that the Republican Party, the leaders, met in secret the day Barack Obama was inaugurated to make a policy of blocking every single fucking thing he tried to do.
Also no discussion of how Barack Obama's healthcare plan was Romney Care
at all. That Barack Obama already marched down to the 20-yard line of the Republican Party and said, look, we're not going to have single payer. We're not going to have a public option.
We're not going to have price controls on pharma right now.
I'm going to give you everything you want. Mm-hmm. But we're going to take the Heritage Foundation plan and we're going to implement it. Everybody cool with that? Fuck you, no, you're a monster. Yep. Look, birth certificates. Oh my God, death panels. So there is, but more interestingly, there is no acknowledgement from the right half of David Brooks's brain of anything he just said during the first half of the interview, which completely negates everything he is now saying. That if your party is indeed, oh, and one of the other things he said is that the idea of a compromise is completely anathema on the right.
Mm-hmm.
It's poison. I mean, there's this sense now that any compromise is completely awful and you're a traitor. And so no compromise. We will never compromise. All right. You have 25 years of people who are brainwashed and dumb enough to vote against their own interests. They believe any compromise is a dirty commie trick to take their freedom away from them. And they have a longing for a strong, authoritarian, fascist type to rule them. And yet you can't seem to understand why when Barack Obama came in and offered compromise, they told him to go pound sand. They told him to fuck off. And that's the part that was kind of entertaining and morbidly fascinating and tragic, because first of all, David Brooks is going to have a job tomorrow and the next month and the next month and 2 years from now. So will Charlie Rose. The Charlie Rose show is, as I said in the piece, the Branson of bad opinions. It's where 90s has-beens go to entertain the octogenarian fans who were still big, who just the hits of the 90s.
Who thinks this is intellectual programming.
You can find Tom Friedman still there.
Yeah.
And I found Donald Rumsfeld was on recently.
Uh-huh.
Talking about the app he had developed.
Yeah, no, it's ideas. That's what's happening there is it's a smorgasbord of ideas over at the Charlie Rose show.
It's a smorgasbord of bad ideas from the 90s.
Yeah.
And we have apparently the previous, you know, the 20 years since just never happened. So David Brooks is still there and still talking about centrism and the importance and the reason that Barack Obama has failed is that the reason that Bernie Sanders cannot succeed is he doesn't have a strategy to get 60 votes. At no point.
51 vote. No one talks about how in that fortune cookie baked into it is an abuse of the filibuster.
Right. Now, David Brooks, this is why no liberals are allowed on television.
Yeah.
Because at that point, it's easy. I'd go, wait, just a second. Explain to me again why you need 60 votes. Oh, because Republicans will filibuster everything. Republicans will filibuster a sunny day if the Kenyan usurper proposes it. Really? And have they shown any sign at all for the last 10 years, 20 years, certainly the last 7 years, of getting any more reasonable? Oh, no, they haven't. In fact, they've gotten much worse. All right. Then how can you still say that Barack Obama failed because he wasn't compromising enough when his opponents clearly stated in bright neon letters 10 miles high, fuck you, we are never going to compromise with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, again, liberals are not allowed on television, because someone would ask the question about 60 votes. Someone would bring up the health care, the Affordable Care Act is a conservative idea. Someone would bring up the dozens of bills, many of which Republicans were the authors of. Mm-hmm. They filibustered
their own bill. Yeah.
Just to screw it. And yet that doesn't exist in the Charlie Rose, David Brooks universe. This is why David Brooks cannot reform himself. Because
we need to change gears now, Driftglass, and talk about money.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because careful what you wish for, Republicans.
Yeah.
It turns out money is speech.
Yeah.
at least from the standpoint of corporations deciding to pull out of states that pass bigoted LGBT bills.
Yeah, yeah.
So North Carolina found out the hard way, and is finding out the hard way, that signing this transgender bathroom bill, which, by the way, is exactly how the Equal Rights Amendment was defeated. I want to connect those two ideas.
Yep, it sure was.
Equal Rights Amendment was simply a bill, an amendment to the Constitution that said gender would not be considered considered part of anti-discrimination of the Constitution. You would be guaranteed rights under the Constitution based on your gender. And Phyllis Schlafly and the right-wing lunatics in the 70s made this about unisex bathrooms. And all of a sudden it was defeated. Nobody wants unisex public washrooms, right?
Right.
So this is exactly what's going on now with the gay rights legislation, which is, oh, well, you know, if you let this happen, then you're going to have unisex bathrooms. Turns out that Kroger, of all places, a specific Kroger grocery store, has had for a number of years, in other places, like a Target, they're called family restrooms. In airports, they're called family restrooms.
Yeah.
It's a big, huge room that has a lock on it and a changing table and a lot of space and a sink. And you go in there and you lock the door and you get to use the bathroom.
Right.
And it is particularly helpful if you are traveling with small children or with an elderly parent, that you can go in, even if you're opposite gendered, and help that person, a person that needs assistance, with their toileting.
Right.
And it's completely private. It's not five stalls. It's one place with a lock. As I had at one time, three small children with me. And we would all go in together and everybody would take turns on this one potty and wash your hands and so on. But it allows you to keep youngest child who has had a tendency to run off a lot from she's in the room with me. And so she, you know, she's locked in there and everyone has to stay. And then you can change a diaper. You know, 4-year old can go to the bathroom. Grandpa can go to the bathroom. Whatever is needed can happen. And this Kroger store mentioned on the sign, LGBTQ, was one of the people who might need this washroom. And we respect that, along with all of the other reasons why you might need this gender neutral bathroom in our store. And no one has a problem with that. If it is expanded, that this benefits everybody. You know, it's not just for transgender people. It's for whoever needs it. And people do need it. So North Carolina is paying the price. Not only are states and municipalities and corporations and everybody pulling non-essential travel to North Carolina from their budgets, but the state's own attorney general has said that this is a national disgrace and he will not defend this law in court.
Yeah.
When the ACLU, who is bringing a lawsuit to stop this law from going into effect, brings it to court, he's not going to be a part of it. Now, they'll find some right-wing lawyers, you know, to go in and defend this bill. But
there always will be.
The Attorney General of North Carolina will be filing an amicus brief calling this law unconstitutional. So, and then you will see, if it makes its way to the 4-4 Supreme Court, that the lower court's ruling often gets upheld like it did in the labor union. This was a big loss for our governor.
Yes,
who wanted to strip unions' rights to collect dues from non-members for the purpose of funding the negotiations, contract negotiations,
right?
Collective bargaining.
Yeah, they wanted the way unions have power is by solidarity and by their bankroll, their war chest. They have to be able to go on strike, first of all. They have to afford it.
Reagan destroyed their ability to do that. In large part.
And if you are a non-union member of a union shop, you enjoy the benefits of their negotiations. You get to dine at their table for free. Right. And what the unions say is, look, if there's a majority here want a union and we vote for a union, we'll collect dues from you, whether you're a member or not. That's just the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like sharing a parking lot or sharing a bathroom. You work here. The majority of people are operating this way. That's how we run things here.
And this is to fund a contract negotiation that will benefit you.
Yeah.
So therefore, you're going to help fund that.
Yeah.
And 4-4 court said, well, we're tied. So the lower court said, no, you cannot strip this right from the unions. They were expecting to lose with Scalia on board.
Yeah, they were.
And so much for that. If the 4-4 court upheld that, and it was a huge loss for Governor Hedge Fund, who really wanted to take this right away from unions.
I don't know if you know this, but conservatives hate working people. Hate them.
They certainly hate unions, and they hate the right to negotiate the terms of your employment is something that they don't want workers to have. Yeah.
So the state where the last controversy was only last year involving the Confederate flag, is also the state that has a real problem with gay people using public accommodation.
Yeah.
Well,
South Carolina was where the state flag, the Confederate flag, was taken down. And this is North Carolina.
Hold on a second. Let me check.
Governor Nikki Haley.
That's true.
Governor Pat McCrory is in North Carolina. And also two other governors, Nathan Deal and also the governor of Virginia, who's a Democrat, both vetoed religious freedom bills in the past 2 weeks, saying, oh, no, we don't want to make Disney or The Walking Dead mad at us. So and now Coca-Cola has drastically reduced their investment in the Republican National Convention.
Yeah.
Of all places.
Yeah.
I am finding this hilarious because I have for a very long time boycotted Home Depot because they funded George W. Bush's second inaugural. And I just find that horrendous. So, you know, I don't set foot in Home Depot. That's my decision. But these companies, including Walmart, including Coca-Cola, including some really big corporations, you know, used to give out free Cokes and tote bags and
cigarettes.
Fine stuff. Not cigarettes. But a lot of in-kind swag, yeah, at these conventions. Corporations would provide or subsidize the internet service at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
You see that a lot. I've been paying attention to this for a long time because the telecom companies really took over the funding of the Democratic National Convention a few years ago, a few cycles ago. And I find that deeply offensive. But yeah, you know, Starbucks, eBay, Citibank, all these companies are saying, oh, no, you know, we can't be associated with an event where the Republican front runner has promised a riot.
Yeah.
That's not good for our business.
I'd like to buy the world a Coke. No. That doesn't go with, and if we don't get our way, the blood will run in the streets.
Run in the streets. Yeah. So they're being very shy about that.
Meanwhile, just a couple of states away. As you mentioned, Nathan Deal learned this lesson.
Mm-hmm.
I call it Salmon P. Chase's March to the Sea. Because Salmon Chase is on the $10,000 bill.
And who is Salmon Chase again?
I believe he was Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury.
Ah, okay.
Or I might be wrong. I'm sure he occupied some other important position. But in fact, since you're pop quizzing me, let me look it up.
Oh, I'm going to look it up. Yeah. Here.
Secretary of State.
Sixth Chief Justice of the United States from 1864 to 1873.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And he's on the $10,000 bill.
He's on the $10,000 bill. He was
in the Whig Party.
He was. Free Soil Movement. Secretary of the Treasury. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, he's on the $10,000 bill. And it turns out millions of dollars are actually more effective at bringing civilization and order to Georgia than thousands of troops were. Because Nathan Deal, the governor, the appropriate, very appropriate name Deal, has announced that he plans to veto a very similar bill in Georgia.
Yeah.
The Let's Discriminate Against Gays bill in Georgia is going to be vetoed by the governor, not because of a great stand on principle, although those are the words he is using, but because it would be economic disaster for the state.
Well, and states, and this Georgia in particular, mm-hmm, has already given away a lot of money to bring these productions to Georgia,
uh-huh,
including one of our favorites,
The Walking Dead.
Archer. Walking Dead and Archer, are both made in Georgia.
Made in Georgia.
So, you know,
and
it's a big deal if those decide to leave. And you know Archer isn't going to stick around.
No.
So,
And I can't imagine the massive cast and crew and extras and infrastructure of The Walking Dead, who are deeply Hollywood types. A very gay-friendly show, by the way.
They yes,
had
it is.
Several gay couples, lesbian couples. They are very friendly to that community. And I cannot imagine them staying in Georgia one more day than they had to under contract, if this law passed. And that, imagine the, because that's a big show.
Yeah.
There are a lot of other companies that pull out and would do financial wreckage to Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm,
the number one show on cable leaving because of this law, you know, Rick saying, I just can't stay here anymore. Me and Carl are packing up. Got to get out of this gay hating hellhole. You know, I just can't. They could not survive that. So,
I think all of us on the left need to learn these lessons. I had a conversation with one of my colleagues about, you know, why aren't we boycotting states that cut funding to Planned Parenthood?
Uh-huh.
And we had a very long conversation on email about, you know, advocating for poor women over and over again, and how, you know, there are so many traitors in our ranks who don't care about you know, if they can fly to California to get their abortion, then they're okay.
Right.
And they don't want to go online to sort of boycott this. Big business doesn't want to side with abortion. Okay. They don't want to be associated with that because it makes so many people, quote unquote, uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite clothing outlets, Land's End, got in big trouble. You remember when I opened that catalog at home? I opened a Land's End catalog, and there was Gloria Steinem wearing Land's End clothes and advertising as, you know, the great woman. You know, she's an example of great womanhood and so on and so forth, and wearing Land's End clothes. And they had to pull back from that advertising because a minority of their customers got upset that a pro-choice person was in the clothing catalog.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had already rolled my eyes at the Gloria Steinem spread in Land's End for a different reason, which is, why is she siding with capitalism?
Yeah. You know? Well.
Why is she deciding to be a fashion model instead of, you know, really sticking to issues that matter? But, you know, she's disappointed me in the past. But really, corporate America goes where the money is.
Oh, yeah.
And so we on the left, I think, need to learn how to use our influence. The African-American community is doing that. They Color of Change is the group that spearheaded this. Why are you siding with funding the RNC when their front runner is so racist?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't make it about political parties. They really honed down their issue of this is about a individual who is siding with white supremacists. And this is the Republican front runner. And this is who is going to be celebrated at this particular convention. And we don't think your brand should be associated with that.
Well, and
it's not about party. So
you experienced this directly in Alabama when you were living there.
Yeah, I did. I lived in Alabama for almost 15 years. And all three of my kids were born in Alabama. This is something that my ex-husband, who was president of the ACLU of Alabama for a few years, always said, which is bigotry is very much alive in the South. It really is. It has had to go underground because people will not bring their conventions to states where you don't acknowledge Martin Luther King Day, where you don't walk the walk in terms of reducing bias and at least having a public face being welcoming to African-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But it has changed from racial bigotry to religious bigotry.
Exactly.
And so it is perfectly okay for a bank teller in Birmingham to have a Bible verse of the day right there on her or his or her checkout line. You know, while you're cashing a check, you've got a Bible verse of the day facing outward to you. Because how could that be offensive to anybody, right?
Sure. I mean,
it's in your face. You'll go through yellow pages, go through the ads on the internet for a plumber, and you will see a Bible verse and a fish logo to say this is a Christian or this is a Christian, because you want your plumber to be a Christian, right?
Sure.
That's important.
Sure.
And it's in your face, Southern Baptists, and they're now. Their bigotry is coming out again over gay rights. Mm-hmm. And it's having to be, as you say, pushed to the sea by money.
Yeah. Yeah. Money will do it.
As Voltaire said, we are all the same religion when it comes to money.
Mm-hmm. Well, and right. even in our local paper, we flipped it open over the weekend and saw a full page ad and a half page ad that were from a chain stores in our area.
Oh, you can say Hobby Lobby. That's all right.
Hobby Lobby.
We know that, everybody knows Hobby Lobby.
You know, it was a crown of thorns and three nails.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, which is fine. As a capitalist, you should have the right to buy advertising that says whatever the hell you want it to say.
Mm-hmm.
But you could not imagine them taking an ad out saying proudly rejecting the business of homosexuals since 1947. Because that is no longer acceptable.
Right.
And that is a good thing. So,
but apparently you can pay your workers minimum wage, use the money that you make from selling your cheap Chinese crap to lobby the legislatures to keep minimum wages low and sue over Obamacare to keep your poor employees who are making minimum wage from having access to contraception through their insurance company. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Did you hear that Rubio wants to keep all his delegates?
I want to keep my delegates. They're mine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he wants to stop Trump, and I mean that. Good luck with that.
Well, it's
little Marco.
Well, it gives him a chip. I mean, he has a chip on the table, and he, if things go brokered, he can make a deal, some kind of deal for. Because right now his political future, he's seen what happened.
He has none. He has none. He's not running for the Senate. So.
No, and Chris Christie has taken that sweet Donald Trump valet job, sweeping up his crumbs and cleaning out his, you know, cleaning his toupee out.
I have one last piece of breaking news.
All right, break me.
It turns out that Reince Priebus is stepping down as RNC chair in 2017, in January of 2017. Isn't that ironic?
Just spend more time with Chris Christie's family. Yeah.
So guess who is on the short list of people to replace Reince Priebus?
This is such a good contest. is it a failed Republican candidate for president this year?
Yes, it is.
Is it? Does she have lady parts?
You are really good.
Is it iCarly?
It is iCarly.
Oh, Lord.
Did you read ahead? Is that how you knew?
No. I just had a flash there. No, I did. No idea. I was just going, okay.
You're really good.
my backup guess was Hugh Hewitt, but he couldn't leave the profitable universe
to do this job.
To do that kind of shitty job. And really, what else is she going to do?
No.
And she has that snide, condescending, kind of asshole approach to everything.
She does. And she can run it like a business. Well, like she drove Hewlett Packard into the ground.
I'm gonna turn this company around. Yeah, you are. I'm sure you will.
2017. She'll be the perfect voice for the failed Republican Party.
And by 2020, she'll be out the door with $100 million check. And the Republican Party will be dead. Will be dead.
Bondage-themed nightclubs eat your heart out.
Doing for the GOP what she did for HP.
We're going to end with a letter from a listener that is hilarious, and I know you will enjoy it, Driftglass.
Okay.
Dear Blue Gal and Driftglass, I have been ravenously listening to your podcast for about a year now and have totally agreed with most of what you have to say. Today, I had an experience that finally spurred me to send you a note of encouragement. First, I want to admit that over the past decade or so, I have gone through much of the same slow realization of the insanity and perniciousness of the conservative movement that you have noted in President Obama. When he was first elected, I too assumed that there had to be someone, some reasonable element of conservatism that would work with him and allow him to govern as president. Maybe because I have several conservative friends and family with whom I could at least have civil and constructive debates. Then I was forced to watch record levels of obstruction slowly empty Obama's and my own big bag of fucks to give. Yes, hat tip Charlie Pierce.
Yep.
And watched in horror as these tactics worked to win elections for Republicans both nationally and in my home state of Wisconsin. Boy, you're on the front lines this week.
Yeah, you sure are.
Yeah. Now I am finally in the same place that you appear to have been for some time, that this brand of conservatism needs to be swept out of our political system for anything worth doing to be accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I say that, I must still have some internal reservations that it could possibly be that bad. Until today.
Until today.
I'm always wary of creating my own liberal bubble, so this morning I decided to turn on the local conservative talk radio. First, let me note that I have no idea how anyone deals with the never-ending string of ads. I seriously had to listen to 7 solid minutes of advertising, including 2 Trump ads and 1 from the American Petroleum Institute, just to get to the show. And the callers to the show were as follows. During a discussion about Trump's latest plan to punish abortions, the first caller said he wanted to talk about the real issues. Are you ready for this, Driftglass? Here are the real issues.
I'm girding myself.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about the abortion thing. I want to talk about the real issues. Mm-hmm. Rebuilding our military, cutting taxes, repealing that Obamacare, and completely deregulating businesses.
Sure.
He didn't mention balancing the budget. Come on.
Come on, man. Well, you only had a couple of, you know, then.
Well, he was on
it. Time's up. Sorry, our time is up. We got to move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Well, so color me shocked. Okay.
So, yeah. All right. So he said, I heard this ridiculous right-wing bingo when all of a sudden the second person called in. and you'll never guess what he wanted to talk about.
Well, I have a long list that it could be. Emails?
Well, you're close. Uh-huh. This person called in to wonder why the hosts weren't talking about how Hillary was just as bad.
Just as bad. Maybe even worse. Maybe even worse.
And since she's as corrupt as the Republican establishment, you have to vote for an outsider no matter what.
No matter what.
And that person is Donald Trump.
He's outside. He ran a business, you know. He's a billionaire. And his wife is so hot. She's so hot.
I was agog. Wingnut bingo followed by both ciderism in consecutive calls. It made me realize just how this stuff seems to be irreparably baked into the conservative hive mind. All of this is to say you guys are fighting the right fight and pointing out the right issues, and I'm only sorry I didn't catch on sooner. Sincerely, Zach. P.S. I recently finished my Ph.D. Congratulations.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. You'd be surprised how much of my dissertation was written listening to the professional left. And yes, I'm totally bragging.
Hope you took out all the fucks. There's that.
Yeah. It turns out postdoc money is way better than grad student money. So I've decided to become a monthly contributor. Aww. Keep up the fantastic work and happy spring. Thank you, Zach. And congratulations again. That is awesome. And we deeply appreciate your monthly contribution.
Thank you, Dr. Zach.
You keep paying our electric bill like that, and we'll get used to having the lights on.
Yeah. Exciting times here in the cornfield.
That's right. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Tiger. Tiger is sprawled on top of his kitty tower in this picture, and he will let you pet him if you show the proper deference. So get that right.
If you show the proper deference.
He really is. He has figured out how to make his body spread out to fill every available space on the top of this tower. It's hilarious. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. And be aware that this is a great time to write us when people are on spring break or getting their gardens ready or whatever. The mail volume has dropped to the point where your email or letter will get more attention than it might ordinarily get, because it's always a low time of year in the spring.
Yeah.
When snow starts to melt and everybody gets outside, that the traffic sort of slows down a little bit, and we're used to that. But this, if you want to get a letter out to us, this is a really good time to do it. Feel free to write us. We do love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local, but we also believe in shopping Amazon with our link at our website if your alternative is a big box store. Approximately 1% of our listeners, plus Zach, now we can add him, support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Driftglass, there's one other thing I wanted to bring up. I wanted to let everyone know, we put up at our Facebook page a Donors Choose link to a teacher named Mr. Sims.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Sims is in California, and he is raising money to buy for his classroom science fiction and fantasy books.
Yay!
My students need science fiction and fantasy novels such as The Martian Chronicles, Earth Abides, and Watership Down to make them love to read again. They are seniors embarking on their final year of high school. My course is a thematic study of science fiction and fantasy, which they chose.
Excellent.
So I am very excited about that. And you and I, you may not know this, Driftglass, you and I donated a little bit of money.
What?
These books are sure to inspire my avid readers and my struggling readers, because when students love what they read, they don't feel forced to pick up a book. And senior year is the last chance to make them fall in love with reading and lifelong learning. Absolutely. Yeah. So we definitely want to support that, and we want to let everybody else know about that, too. So that will be in the links also for our on our blogs on Blue Gal and Driftglass. If you want to go over and drop a few bucks in the hat for that particular project, it's all the money goes to the project, and it's a good cause. So I wanted to highlight that.
Creating literate citizens.
Creating literate citizens through science fiction. Science fiction. Mm-hmm. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. Hey, Drift Glass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
You know, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties still have lots of Rubio delegates stuck under the sofa.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Just think about loving.
Think about loving.
Just think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, loving, loving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying and the flower and the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Love Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Drift Glass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Drift Glass.
Science Fiction University, we are reading three more stories that you have submitted of your first four paragraphs. And this, we believe, is the last week that we have stories to read to you. Mm-hmm. So we have a new writing prompt. And this one is going to be a visual one. Is that right, Drift Glass?
That is true. If we have by chance missed your story because I'm an idiot, or because you didn't label it like what we asked you to, let us know.
I don't know what we asked them to, but we're going to ask you this time.
Science Fiction
That's
University.
For sure. Yes.
Science Fiction University submission. Something in that wheelhouse.
Yeah, not I think the word submission needs to be in your subject line. Yeah.
Not professional left writing.
No.
that'll skip right on through. But I think we have the last three. I'm pretty sure we do. If we don't, again, let us know and we will loop yours into the
next. We will loop yours in and read it on the air. We will do that.
But
coming up after next week's episode, mm-hmm. we will be starting again. Next week we'll do a quiz, and then the following week we'll start up again reading your submissions.
Yes.
And Drift Glass, we have a visual, correct?
We do. My wife is the daughter of artists, mother of artists, and is a fine artist in her own right. Visual artist. She's also an amazing writer. And so Blue Gal will curate for you some fine example of famous science fiction cover art. She will pick something by Eggy or Bonstell or Frazetta or somebody.
Or some unknown woman author,
yes.
writer, right, whatever.
Absolutely. But she will procure a famous piece of science fiction cover art that we will post to our website and our Facebook pages.
Yes.
And then you, dear listeners, will write the first 4 to 5 paragraphs of that story. And it can be anything you want, but it has to be prompted by that visual cue. Now, this is because during the golden age of pulp science fiction, this is actually how things got done sometimes. They would commission someone to do a painting, cover art painting, for an issue in 3 months or 4 months or whatever. And then they'd bring it in and say, okay, write the story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, write it to spec. It has to be X number of words. You get paid, a quarter cent a word or half a penny a word. And they'd crank this stuff out. And some really bad stories were produced, but some really wonderful stories were produced this way. And it's always interesting to me what people take away from a piece of art. The thing on the canvas that prompts them to want to write a particular story. Sometimes it's a face, sometimes it's a context, sometimes it's a shadow, sometimes it's just some obscure detail that I never noticed. But it's always interesting. So that's your assignment for the next chapter of the Science Fiction University.
And again, it's going to be 4 paragraphs
mm-hmm.
or less.
Yep.
And you will write it just based on this picture, whatever this picture says to you. And that's it. So it'll be a good one. It'll be one that has lots of different avenues to go with. So
and if this picture says to you that you should submit something you wrote a year ago, we will know.
Okay.
New work, hands on keyboards, writing exercise. Sit down mm-hmm. and write it. But that's in a couple of weeks. This week, however, we're going to close out our submission, this assignment in Science Fiction University, with 3 more stories from 3 more listeners.
Yes, we are. And we're starting with Derek.
Mm-hmm.
And Derek writes, this is his story. Gannon switched on the device. Immediately, a low, warm hum sounded, and the silver metallic casing began to warm in his hands. A welcome sensation in the crisp early winter air. He placed the flat rectangular device on the stand in front of him, sliding it into the firm black frame. He watched silently as the screen replaced the Dino Labs logo with the bright heads-up display. Quickly, he entered the required numbers next to the golden letters at the top of the screen. He had done the calculations long ago. Gannon activated the scan sequence, and the beams of red, yellow, and blue light seemed to shoot from the back of the device, forming single lines at first, then oscillating back and forth faster and faster until the beams formed the outline of a cube. 22 feet, 7 inches long to a side, Gannon knew well, no more, no less. The beams seemed to go straight through any object in their path in that section of the old deserted playground that the cube now covered. All the tall yellowed grass and rusted broken-down swings and slides were irrelevant to the process. Gannon shivered unconsciously as an icy breeze blew, while the cube started to fill with the colored lights, forming swirling, changing patterns of the primary colors on each side. Soon, so soon now, Gannon thought, as he watched the numbers on the screen tick off first hours, then days, then years, with increasing speed. This is what he had truly developed this device for. Yes, the device would be a priceless treasure for historians, archaeologists, and anthropologists, and would undoubtedly be used to solve countless unsolved mysteries. But this was the moment that had driven him on, to break through every barrier in the last 5 years to complete this, the first working prototype. The numbers finally zeroed out, and Gannon waited what seemed like endless seconds as the word compiling flashed in gold on the screen. At last, the play icon appeared, and Gannon's hand, shaking now, reached out to activate it. Immediately, a scene appeared on screen, a bright summer day with a playground filled with children. A bittersweet smile formed on Gannon's face as he recognized the sight of his little brother waiting his turn to climb up the stairs of a bright red slide.
Ooh. Yeah.
All right, recall.
Well, there's a lot of colors going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Very clear that the primary colors, red, RGB, red, green, I'm sorry, no, they're blue, yellow, red.
And red.
There's red slide. There's winter air, icy winter air, which is very evocative. And it's a dead playground. It's abandoned. It's weedy. It's overgrown. It's gone. And that he is clearly out there on this cold night doing something he probably shouldn't be doing. There's a low hum that you can feel through your hand almost as you read the story, and so forth. I have many questions about this story, but I'd like to go through with the recall, see if you pull anything else out.
He is a scientist. This is work for him. He has developed this device as an experiment for a long time. Wherever he is, there are seasons. And it's cold. It's wintertime where he is. I really like at the end where his little brother is on the slide, because that sort of then humanizes the whole story.
Yeah.
And you realize you're dealing with someone that has human emotions, that has invented this thing, whatever it is, and human relationships. So, yeah, that I like that very much. But go ahead.
I have questions. I have questions, as youngest child always says.
Youngest child.
Always precedes a question with, I have a question.
Uh-huh.
I have a few questions. First of all, I would recommend you finding a name for this thing, because the word device has been repeated a few times too often. It calls attention to itself. You can switch on the device once or twice, but I think it occurs like five. That word just keeps popping out. If you're a scientist and you spend however long building this thing, you know that joke about the horse with no name?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're in the desert with a horse with no name. You're going to name the goddamn horse.
Right.
At some point, you're going to, if you're the guy who built this thing, you're going to have a name for it.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I think you built this, our protagonist built this for a corporation. He must have. There's a Dino Labs logo.
Yeah.
It's not something he knocked together in his garage. It couldn't possibly be. So he built this for an organization that presumably has some idea what it can do. So if he truly has developed the first portal through which you can either observe past events or interact with past events, the first would be revolutionary and amazing. The second would be unbelievably dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if it is a thing that he would have to have smuggled out of the lab.
In which case there's an element of danger involved in your story.
Seems like he's gone out to a field and just set this thing up, and it's cool. That's just fine. He hasn't tripped any alarms. Nobody has sort of, holy shit. I mean, when Bill Murray stole the heavily armed recreational vehicle in Stripes, everybody went apeshit.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's walked out the door with possibly the most important invention in human history, other than fire and electricity. He's walked away with it, and it would seem to me that I'm wondering if there's some peril involved in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, this is very good because you've left it at a really good place. I don't know if this guy wants to go back and beat up his little brother because he won the fight on the playground that day, or his little brother died.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to save him.
Right.
But I can't imagine just observing the events is sufficient to make the story go. He's got to want to intervene somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a time travel.
That's what I expect. Right.
Yeah. This is a time travel story.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I love me some time travel. So have fun with it. The tricky bit about time travel stories is you have to make all the loose ends tie together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have to answer some questions or at least shrug them off with some elegance. But I love a time travel story. Please continue. Just the first couple of paragraphs are a little too much gadget for me.
Mm-hmm.
A little
mm-hmm.
too many whirs and clicks and lights going off and on and so forth. If he invented it and built it and has been working on it for months and months and months, that level of detail about it coming on, whatever, wouldn't be on his mind. So it wouldn't be on his page. It would be in the mind. His mind would be getting to the moment in time that he wants to affect.
Yep.
So a couple of cuts and you're well on your way.
Very good. All right. You're next.
Yes, I am next. I am going to read.
Next.
I'm going to read a story. I'm not sure where the story starts.
Story Foreign Worker Janitor.
Yeah.
That's where we're going to start.
I think that's the title, but I'm not sure. But that's okay. That's a formatting issue. That's not a story issue.
Mm-hmm.
We have a story called...
So this is from Christopher.
Christopher. This is a Foreign Worker, parentheses, janitor, close parentheses. Chapter 0, Stick with a Nail in It. Poetry. Yep, poetry. It's all in how you look at it. I guess it's all how you frame it. Sorry, it's the 2x4. Framing. Right, never mind. Of course, not all 2x4s are equal. For instance, this one had a nail in it. A good old number 10 galvanized wood nail with a fine spiral, now slightly bent. It's an amazing thing how the mind focuses on minutiae when under stress. Of course, I doubt my faithful friend yonder 2x4 is causing this stress. Much the opposite. No, it's definitely the gun pointed at me. Not a good start. Now, I'm sure you're waiting for a flashback somehow relating to some semblance of events which led up to this point. Heh, so am I. Focus, capital letters, exclamation point. So here I am staring at a gun pointed in my general direction. They don't look happy. I'm not averse to gendered pronouns, but well, what with the robe and evil look, I don't want to judge. Mighty big hat they're wearing. They might be important. Probably best I don't mention the feather boa. Again, I don't want to judge. Focus! Exclamation point. Time to shine. Say something clever that'll distract the unhappy gun holder guy with my awesome wit and save my skin. What? I say to shatter the pregnant pause. What? I say to shatter the pregnant pause. An A for effort, I'm sure, that'll cause some aspiring editor to scoop out their bowel with an oyster fork. In terms of delivery, I peg it somewhere between nasal and whiny, like a pervert caught doing something inappropriate at a movie theater. Perfect. I'm so dead. What is the sound of one hand clapping? I don't know, but I now know what the sound of a vein popping on a forehead is. Wow, now that's anger. The shaking barrel of the gun isn't doing anything good for my state of mind. Of all the things I expected them to do, not shooting immediately wasn't very high on the list. Of course, we haven't gotten to know each other yet. I glanced down. I really shouldn't have. I'm sure you're no ghoul, not judging, but it's probably best left unsaid what I saw. Well, I'm pretty sure I now know why I'm attracting the attention of the one with the gun now. Pity. Also, a 2x4 with a nail in it is a really effective weapon by at least one account. Who was it that said superior weaponry was a relative and not an absolute measure? Pity about the gun. Why? The gun-toting person hissed. Yes, I know there are no sibilants in that. They still hissed it. Great. A philosopher, once you get them going, you can never shut them up. So why are they wearing a feather boa? Why do they want to ask someone a deep question that's holding a 2x4 with a nail in it, standing above a battered corpse? Philosophers. There just plain need to be less of them. Pity about the gun. Let's hear it for trying something clever. You're welcome, I say with a smile. At least I think it's a smile. It's not like I can emote them or something. Yup, always be selling. A sign of an excellent salesperson. For you kids at home, do remember this sage advice. Definitely don't commit homicide before your first coffee of the day, or you'll just cover yourself in glory. Yup, that wonderful fragrant glory. And never mention what it smells like. What a mess. Seriously, who leaves someone standing over a corpse with a gun pointed at them? Ah, well, guess I'll just have to clean it up. Maybe the gun-toting poster child for anger management over there wants to help. So, you come here often? Corny pickup lines for the win. They really don't look well, and as a bonus, they still haven't shot me. Well, maybe I'll enjoy this job. More likely, I'll fall afoul of an evil for which there is no name. Monster under a courtyard, or other bloody-minded trope. Looks like lots of overtime on this job. Too bad there's no danger pay. But being bipedal is a plus. Is it too much to ask for flush toilets this time? The end.
All right. Clever, clever, and had some fun with it. Mm-hmm. I like how this character has a distinctive voice. You know this guy is a jokester or uses humor to deal with stress. Mm-hmm. And he is either smarter or more communicative than his captors or employers or whatever that is. You're going to have to move things along a little faster in your plot as you proceed, because the first person narrative drags along a little bit. Mm-hmm. We need to see what's going to happen soon with these guys.
Very soon.
Very soon. Uh-huh. So there's that.
Yeah. Zooming out, someone is holding someone else hostage.
Mm-hmm.
That someone appears to be wounded, perhaps. I don't know. Or pooping himself or something. He's looking down and covering himself with glory. I don't know what that means exactly, but I assume it's bad. There's a corpse there involved. At this point, I have no idea if this is a science fiction story or not.
Mm.
And the internal monologue of someone... This is either someone who is panicked and his mind is racing... or he's someone who is flippant and is completely in charge of the situation. Mm-hmm. So it's either Humphrey Bogart in The Big Sleep.
Or Bill Murray.
Or Bill Murray.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the interior monologue, which is all we have to go on, I don't know which it is.
Mm-hmm.
He seems way too meta about his own situation. Oh, I bet you were expecting a flashback. Well, no, you're not going to get one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that means we know you've survived this encounter or you wouldn't be having this conversation with us. I don't know what his state of mind is. I would like to see us jump outside of the frame of this story and look in on it at least for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
What does he look like?
Mm-hmm.
Is he
mm-hmm.
sweating? Is he wearing a jogging suit? Is the person holding a gun on him a four-legged alien?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a mobster? All we have is a flash internal monologue from someone whose motives are unclear, whose reason for being there is unclear, and for clearly he's planning an escape. He's planning an action, and so forth. So this probably belongs in the middle of a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Once you have taken us through the crime scene and the interaction and whatever the hell happened, the in medias res means in the middle of things, but I like to mm-hmm. think of it as in the middle of the action. The problem with this is there's no action.
Yeah.
Nothing has happened in this page and a half. This is a reaction to something that has already happened, which you can get away with as long as we know what's going on. But at this point, we don't.
Yeah. And you might even back up and write just for your own edification. And you might, none of this might make it into the story, but I would like to know what an average day was like for this person before this happened. And, and once you know what that character is and what an average day was for him before this terrible thing happened, mm-hmm. you can then bring more of his character into the story. I think of, we just talked about the movie Stripes.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't start with him joining the army. It starts with him having the absolute worst day a human being can possibly have. He loses mm-hmm. his job, his girlfriend, everything. You know, he mm-hmm. has nothing left. And so we do know who this guy is before the drama, mm-hmm. you know, the real core of the story happens. We know a lot about him.
Mm-hmm.
He has nothing to lose.
Yeah.
So,
he's a loser.
And he's a loser. So we need to know more about this guy from that standpoint. Like, what was his life? What is an average day like for him?
Mm-hmm.
And how did he get here? Yeah, mm-hmm. that question from the Talking Heads. From Talking Heads. Well, how did he get here? So and that may be an exercise for you to get the story, to make the story better. That doesn't. A lot of it doesn't wind up in the story, but this way you know that character. You know what this character is. And then you can write better about
it. Again, this is a recounted story. You're telling, mm-hmm. your narrator is telling this to presumably the audience. I mean, he does a direct address to someone.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're expecting mm-hmm. this flashback.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this would make an editor cringe or you know, which is fine. But at that point, we're sort of on to what's going on. Oh, this, mm-hmm. this is, the only time I know where anyone's gotten away with that in a way that was surprising is Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Where you have a corpse narrating.
Yes.
A corpse narrates the entire movie. And mm-hmm. you know it's a corpse because the first thing you see is his body floating face down in Gloria Swanson's
room. Mm-hmm.
And so, boom, that's a way to start a story, man. But at this point, all we know is, at some future time, this is being recounted, as mm-hmm. far as I can tell, to someone. So you've sort of immediately taken the peril out of the picture.
Mm-hmm. And he might be at a writer's workshop.
Yeah.
You know, he might be actually telling this story at a futuristic writer's workshop. And like, oh, you expect a flashback here, but no.
Oh, I was thinking it might be a fight at a writer's workshop.
That
would be hilarious.
Would be fun. But there are all kinds of ways that writers can get into narration or distance themselves from narration.
Yeah. He's like,
I'm reading a wonderful book called Lost Time Accidents. It just came out this year, and I did link it at our Facebook page. If you're, I know some people don't do Facebook, but you can Google it by clicking the Amazon link at our website and going and looking up the Lost Time Accidents. And I won't give away any spoilers except to say that he uses the act of writing and reading someone's writing, either in a diary or in a letter or in a journal or a scientific record of experiment notes, so that you get to see what happened, but you have some emotional distance from it. So you know something happened, but you're reading this. Someone's reading a letter about something terrible that happened. So you know that the person reading the letter is okay, right? He's okay. You're okay. You're reading this horrible tragedy, but you have a little bit of distance from it. Margaret Atwood at the end of Handmaid's Tale turns the entire scene over to an academic conference where they are talking about the events of this story. Mm-hmm. Because the story you just read survived.
Right.
And so now, you know, 60, 70 years later, there's an academic conference about the horrible things that happened in this traumatic dystopian story that you just read. So, you know, everything, it kind of got okay somehow.
Yeah.
Or at least some people on the planet survived and were okay enough to talk about it with some distance. So, that's a way to bring in, you know, a horribly violent story. Like, this guy has a gun pointed at him and there's a dead body in front of him and there's all these things, but he's talking about it as a survivor to a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very funny and is entertaining and witty and charming and so forth.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then what is an average day like for him now as an academic or as a celebrity or, you know, however you decide. What has he become? Is he famous for this story? And therefore, there's this huge audience there listening to him tell the story. Is he just an average janitor who's on a reality show?
Yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of ways you could do this.
May I suggest you toss the stick with a nail in it down on the corpse that you just killed, saying defiantly, "No, David Foster Wallace is overrated."
I've had it with your David Foster Wallace references.
And now turn around and the gun pointing guy, now go ahead and shoot me.
Now go ahead and shoot me. Drew Glass, I think you've been to that conference.
I have been. I've had panels at that conference. And they ended in tears, I will say. Bloodshed and tears.
All right, let's move on to the next one.
But you're having fun with it, and that's a good thing. So keep having fun with it.
Yeah.
But, and here's a rule for everybody, not just for this story. Every paragraph has to pay its own way.
Mm-hmm.
It has to pull it has to pull the cart, and anything that isn't pulling the cart in any story, and the cart is the narrative, the plot, the character development that's leading you to the end of the story. Anything that isn't pulling the cart, feel free to get rid of it. You're an artist. You're allowed to throw things away. All right.
I wanted to add one thing to another place that you can find the image that we're going to put up. Huh? If you follow us on Twitter at ProLeftPodcast, I will post the image there.
Ooh.
And a lot of people who don't do Facebook do Twitter. Yeah. So it will be up at ProLeftPodcast, all one word. I will make sure it gets over there too. Okay.
Or when you're coming over to driftglass.blogspot.com during my fundraiser.
Happy blogiversary. Yes, we'll get to that. Yeah.
Thank you. But third story.
Third story from Joe.
Mm-hmm.
It was the dawn of 1957. Without warning, we found ourselves at war again, just not with each other this time. In less than 2 weeks, vast swaths of humanity were either dead or blindly fleeing for their lives before an invasion from space so swift and brutal we had no time to react. I leaned forward, pressing the ice-cold antique binoculars close against my eyes, intently sweeping the broad, barren valley below for any sign of movement, shivering. Between the icy dampness of the bunker and the polar winds moaning outside, concentration was a challenge. The view from my vision port was a bleak gray panorama of bare granite, blending into the rushing clouds above. Except for patches of snow in the shadows and ridgeline we occupied, the flatness of the scene made it difficult to calculate distance or depth. The wide basin rolled out in front of me, a small icy lake near the bottom of the draw, mirrored clouds as they passed over, and a few low wind-worn trees waved back and forth in the gale. Small camouflaged bunkers, relics of a previous war, sat deep in a wide semicircle to the left of me. The squat round casements were half a kilometer apart, guarding one of the few passes through the mountains, according to our maps. Each concealed a single soul, 2 days' rations of stale biscuits, a few green cans of salty meat called tushanka, and a flashlight to communicate in dots and dashes to each other. Radios were useless when the mushroom clouds became visible over the horizon, and in our flight, we buried the heavy equipment, making room for any food and ammunition we came across on the lorries. Where we were heading, those things would surely be in short supply. I was one of 8 forward artillery spotters conscripted into service only 6 days ago as part of what was the remnants of the Soviet 21st Mountain Cavalry Division, moving east through the village I was visiting. Anyone able to stand upright, even wayward astronomers like myself, were swept up in the exodus heading for the relative safety of the high ground to the east. Now, after a week weaving our way through the mountains, we found ourselves dug in on the flanks a nameless U-shaped valley in northern Kamchatka. Behind us, about a kilometer away, sat 3 medium-caliber field guns the unit had on hand when deployed for the annual bivouac weeks before. Whether or not they would be effective wouldn't be known until the first round lofted down the valley hit its target. That one singular round would determine the course of the battle, the war, and our very lives. As secure and hidden as we were, there was little comfort in knowing that we were between the advancing alien army and our artillery behind us. Is this how the rat feels staring back at the cat? The weather-worn walls of the bunker suddenly didn't seem so safe or secure anymore as night approached. Ironic, I thought. We had gone from taking our first steps towards exploring the very edge of space only to be thrust back a millennia in a matter of hours.
Well.
All right.
Recall should be, I mean, this is a very, very richly detailed story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doing something really hard. We'll get to the problems with it in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you're describing essentially a wasteland, a mm-hmm. detail-less cold wasteland. You're doing a really good job of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're telling us about the clouds blending into the ground. We know exactly where you are. You're almost describing a battle site, and it's really hard to keep things straight on a battlefield. And you're doing a very good job of telling us where things are relative to our protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
We know he's a wayward astronomer who was just swept up in this battle. How he knows so much about military equipment, I don't know. But I assume that'll come out later in the story since he was just recruited 6 days ago. This happened lightning fast. This is an alternate history story. Perfectly well within the confines of science fiction. The vast army from space has invaded the Earth looking for our women and our booze. We have to fight them. We must fight them. This reminds me a little bit of, this is always going to happen. This reminds me a little bit of, I can't think of the author's name, Harry Turtledove's World War series,
mm-hmm.
where aliens invade during World War II.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And all kinds of really unusual alliances are formed where people would normally loathe each other. But that's like a 3-volume series, and it's a very good series. Well, the first couple of books are, anyway. So this is well within the confines of science fiction. We know how he feels. We know the cold. And we know it's cold because we can feel it on our nose, on our eyes. The ancient binoculars that he pressed are icy. So it's a dreary Russian friggin' wasteland. But you have used a lot of wonderful adjectives and comparatives to tell us what it looks like and why it looks the way it does. So on that level, it works just fine.
Right.
Anything to add, Blue Gal?
Well, do you want to talk about the problems with it next, or do you want to? Yes. That's kind of where I want to go with this.
Yes.
Not to be critical, because I think you've got something here, and
you
I
do.
Think you can really move forward with this. This is always the first draft is hard, and you want to get it down on paper so you can fix everything. Editing is a different process.
So keep
from
going.
Writing. So keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea from reading this story that this guy is Russian, except that you tell me that he is. And so, and it's, I know what year it is. I know it's 1957.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to get your 50s Russian history into the story. Again, we're going back. What was an average day like for this guy before this happened? You need to find that out. It's exactly the same issue as with the earlier story. If he's a Russian astronomer, then he had a job to do. You know, if he was part of the space race, you know, that becomes a really important part of how he talks, how he sees the world. Is he someone who previous to this looked at the future as, you know, the great Russian triumph over the West? Mm-hmm. Is he someone that simply dragged through the horrific years of Stalin and survived and just got through it, and all of a sudden
is he a
Stalin
student?
Doesn't matter anymore? Yeah.
Yeah. Is he an old man? Is he a student?
But those are the kind of things, even though, I mean, this, it sounds like we're being contradictory in our instructions, because we did ask you to start in the middle of the story.
Yeah.
And maybe this then comes after, where he flashes back and remembers his girlfriend, or remembers his job, or remembers something.
Exactly.
And that's fine. But we need to know more about who this person is. And particularly, we need to know why being Russian is important to the story.
Yeah.
Because it is important to the story, clearly. And you've got the geography down beautifully. I mean, this is, they're escaping to a place. I mean, you talk ironically, and I think we just strike that out at the end, the part about ironically, we're looking to space, and now, you know, we've been thrust back a millennia. The irony is that they are escaping to a place where people were sent to as prison, you know, they're escaping to Siberia. And so, you know, the irony is this is a place where people were sent to be punished. And now this is going to be the last hope for humanity. So and it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds, too. Is cold a weapon against the aliens?
Right.
Is being isolated important? You know, there's a lot that you can do with this that I think will make it work really well. So
you've effectively cut them off from the outside world, which is a choice, and I like it as a choice.
Yeah, yeah.
The radios don't work, so they have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world. They have no way to coordinate strategies. Just them and their, you know, little bit of food and weapons hauling ass out of the war zone, trying to find a safe place to make a stand. Which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue. So keep going. In case we weren't clear, keep going. This is a good. This is a rock solid submission to any science fiction magazine. The first four paragraphs would, you'd make it past the first hurdle right now. Except the following. We're going to collect a series of punctuation marks, and we're going to mail them to you. Because we read through this story. This is our well, I should say Blue Gal. This is Blue Gal's fourth read through.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of commas missing.
Yeah.
And they change the meaning of sentences entirely.
Yeah.
So here's what you want to do. You want to make it so easy for the editor to say yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That they, this is obviously, it should flow really smoothly. I mean, everything, mm-hmm. word choice, setting, pacing, everything should be written if you're submitting for publication to make it easy for the editor to want to buy your story.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit 5, 6, 7 different places in the story where, that sentence, the meaning changed entirely because there's a missing semicolon or a missing mm-hmm. comma.
Mm-hmm.
And that is second draft, third draft business. This is,
right.
is first draft.
Right.
But it was noticeable because you set up a really good pace. We were cooking right along and then bang, we hit a roadblock and like, what is that? What does he mean? Oh,
if there's a comma that goes over there, not over here. Right. Or, right.
That's not the word he meant. He meant this other word.
Yeah.
That is a good sign because you had us.
Yeah.
Then you lost us, but only due to technical errors.
I wish everyone that submitted Everything Everywhere would read what they wrote out loud before they submit it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I mean that for bloggers and everybody else in the world. Yeah. If you read it out loud one time, you'll notice where and I don't always do that with stuff I write, but
well, I will reveal my terrible secret if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
I am a wonderful editor of other people's work.
Yep.
But my brain is wired so that I literally cannot see my own errors.
Mm-hmm.
Until I've let it cool on the shelf for like a day.
Sure, sure.
So I just can't. I go over it and over and over it, and I miss the same thing over and over and over again, which is why they teach you, read your story out loud, and then read it backwards, and then put it on a tape recorder. I actually had a writer tell me to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Tape it, put it in another room, and listen to it carefully from a distance.
Oh,
so
wow.
You have to strain to hear it. You know, really put it through the sieve over and over and over again, which if you're submitting to Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction is really good practice. If you're blogging and you're blasting through one post and it goes click, 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 and you're done for the day and you have to go back and do it again the next day, then it's not really practical advice.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just don't have the time or the mental energy to do that. But for writing for publication where someone is going to write you a check and say, for this story that is going to be in this print magazine, it's worth it. It's totally worth it to go over it and over it and over it again. And you will find these things. And the only reason we're emphasizing this is because the stories you all have submitted so far have been really good.
Yeah. We have a very talented audience.
And we urge you to keep going. So way to go, Joe. Congratulations. Rock solid piece of science fiction writing. I want to know what these aliens look like. I want to know what this guy's going to do next. I want to know if you used Risk, the board game, as a map of the area.
All right.
I like the whole story. And way to go, and keep up the good work.
So look for the image that I have selected on our Facebook page, our Twitter stream, which is at ProLeft Podcast, at Driftglass, which is, you can Google Driftglass, and Blue Gal. You can Google Blue Gal. We will have it at all four places. And we'll see what you come up with. You have 2 weeks. The deadline for submission to send us 4 paragraphs based on this image will be April 13th, Wednesday, April 13th at midnight. You submit it by emailing it not as an attachment. People were very good about this.
Yeah.
Not as an attachment, not as a share. Just paste it into an email and send it to proleftpodcast@gmail.com and put submissions, SFU or Science Fiction University submission in your subject line. And April 13th, again, midnight is the deadline, and we will see what you have and take a look at this image and see what you come up with.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
It'll be fun. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Driftglass. I love you.
I love you too, darling. Bye.
Bye.